Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The Navajo Nation is the largest Indian reservation in the country, spanning 27,000 square miles across parts of Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico. Before COVID-19, the Navajo community was dealing with an underfunded healthcare system. Also, access to basic necessities like water. According to the Navajo Water Project, 1 in 3 Navajo still do not have a sink or a toilet. Navajo are 67 times more likely than other Americans to live without running water or a toilet. And about 1/3 of Navajo families haul water home every day. This is directly connected to broken treaties and U.S. obligations. Now the Navajo are facing the coronavirus crisis. There are nearly 1,600 confirmed cases of the virus and 58 reported deaths on the Navajo Nation. Dr. Michelle Tom, a Navajo doctor on the front lines, told NBC News, "You're saying 20 seconds of wash your hands with water. We have to haul our water. We do not have plumbing. That is how I grew up." Well, we invited Dr. Tom to join us today, but she had to decline because she is extremely busy helping her community. We are joined by two guests. Jordan Bennett Begay is Washington editor at Indian Country News, and she has been extensively covering these issues. Jordan is a Diné citizen, and she's based in Washington, D.C. Hi, Jordan. Welcome to the show. Thanks again for joining us.
Hi, Yata. Thanks for having me, Rose.
Great to have you. How are you and your family and your loved ones doing, Jordan?
We're hanging in there. I think they're definitely trying to keep themselves busy, especially when jobs are, the hours are being cut for jobs, and they're trying to take care of like nieces and nephews at home, but they're trying their best to keep a positive attitude throughout all of this.
Good. Well, we're glad to hear that. We're also joined today by Emma Robbins, director of Dig Deep's Navajo Water Project. It's an indigenous-led, community-managed utility alternative that brings hot and cold running water to homes without access to water or sewer lines on the Navajo Nation. It is the first system of its kind in the United States. Emma is a Diné citizen who grew up in one of the areas with the highest concentration of water poverty, and she splits her time between the Navajo Nation and Los Angeles. Hi, Emma. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Bennett, Jordan, how are you? Honored to be here with you as well. It's good to talk with y'all, and I'm happy that we're discussing this important issue.
Yeah, I'm happy that we are too. And Emma, how are you and your loved ones doing?
Thank you for asking. I think exactly like Jordan said, people are trying to go about their daily lives while continuing this normalcy, but also, taking care of themselves by staying home. Although I split my time between the Navajo Nation and Los Angeles, I'm currently here in LA. And for me personally, it's been very tough to not be able to be with family or with the communities mm-hmm. that we serve during this time. I'll also say I'm spending a lot of time in LA, which is new for me. In terms of my family, they're hanging in there, and it's tough when you're hearing about community members and friends and family that you know of who are very sick or passing, but right. Working to change that.
Well, and Emma, I spent some time on your website, the Navajo Water Project, and you're all doing such important work. Before diving in and talking about that, I just want to talk about what Indian Country is facing and bring in a little bit of historical context, because I noticed that a lot of national media outlets are now covering this and talking about the fact that there's still not, running water for everyone in Indian Country. Some media outlets mention treaties, a lot of them don't. And I think it's really important to start off talking about treaties. NPR did. They interviewed Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez, who says, "We are U.S. citizens, but we're not treated like that. You can hear the frustration, the tone of my voice. We once again have been forgotten by our own government." So, Emma, can you start us off by just talking about how what Indian Country is dealing with today is directly connected to broken treaties and U.S. obligations?
That's a great question and a great point. So I will speak the most about the Navajo Nation, obviously being Diné myself. I am aware of other treaties throughout Native Nations, but experiencing life on the Navajo Nation, I'll be able to talk a lot more about that. I think it's definitely what Jonathan Nez said. You know, for me personally, I consider myself a citizen of the Navajo Nation before a citizen of the U.S. That's not to say that I personally don't hold a U.S. passport. I don't vote. I don't pay taxes. Yes, I do. But it is important to first and foremost recognize where we're from. I think a lot of it is due to broken treaties. You know, obviously water is such a precious resource, and it's been exploited time and time again by federal, state, and county governments. And we need to make sure that we're referencing our treaty from 1868 and saying, look, this is our agreement with the United States, and you need to come and help us. It's not that we can't stand up and do the work ourselves, but we will be able to stand up and do the work ourselves, not only during this pandemic, but other things that we as Native nations face 365, 24/7. And we can do that when we collaborate and when we are receiving what we're supposed to get from the federal government.
Right. And we're talking about things like water, like housing, like infrastructure and healthcare.
Yeah, exactly. You know, healthcare is something that a lot of people don't know that we receive from the federal government in terms of IHS or Indian Health Service hospitals. One thing that I've experienced as an adult is IHS hospitals switching to being 638 hospitals, which are hospitals that are owned and operated by the Navajo Nation. And, you know, when we do have things like that happen, a lot of that comes with responsibly honoring treaties and allowing us to own things that we should in the first place.
Yeah, I think it's such a great point, and it really needs to be discussed in the media now that this issue is getting more attention. Jordan, what would you add?
I would add that I agree, like, the mainstream media is covering this, and I think one important point that they should understand is that IHS is only a small portion of the entire Indian health system. When I did the math, it was about 17% of the Indian health system. And as Emma pointed out, like, a lot of these tribes or these tribal health clinics are owned and operated by tribes. And that makes up like 83% of the entire system, entire Indian health system. So I think that's one important factor that needs to be considered, is that IHS is a small part of this. You also have to think about when people are trying to get tested, you know, for COVID-19, like, are they getting covered by Medicaid? Are they being referred outside the Indian health system? You know, there are definitely a lot of other factors to consider. And these treaties are, you know, legally binding contracts that are defined by the by the United States Constitution, saying that they are the supreme law of the land. And this pandemic is just really exacerbating, you know, a lot of issues that we already knew from the very beginning, right? The chronic underfunding, but also that Native people and tribal governments, tribal nations were, you know, a second thought and often just put on the back burner. And now it's really being shown at this time.
Right. And I think it's important that people are shocked when they hear that one in three Navajo do not have a sink or a toilet. I mean, we're told to wash our hands on a regular basis. We're even told to wash things that are coming in. But how do you do that without running water? And again, Emma, this didn't just happen. I mean, there's a reason why one in three Navajo do not have a sink or a toilet. There's a reason why Navajo are 60 times more likely than other Americans to live without running water or a toilet.
Yeah, I mean, the first point that you touch on is an important one. You know, if we don't have this from, you know, these systematic oppressive lack of treaty acknowledgement and honoring, it's something where when you don't have a sink and you can't wash your hands, that is spreading the disease in a lot of ways, and you're not able to protect yourselves. When you don't have running water in your home for drinking or cleansing, and you have to go to a store or you have to haul water miles away, you're putting yourself at risk. You know, what we're seeing on the reservation and in many other places is that you get to a store and there's a limit as to how many items you can buy. That includes drinking water. And so a lot of times, families or individuals travel long distances, spending gas, taking time from caring for people in their family to arrive to these locations where, for lack of a better way to say it, they almost traveled in vain. It's it's something that, again, like you said, it makes me personally angry and me personally sad to think that it's taking a pandemic for people to realize that that's a problem. I mean, again, to really emphasize, this is something that at least 30% of Navajos deal with. And it's something that we are able to change, but we're not going to be able to do it unless we take action now. It should not take a pandemic to make us spark some change and get with the program.
Right. And this is a big question, and this is definitely for another show, to really go over the history of treaties, because this is something that, you know, doesn't get that much attention outside of Indian country. Vox had an interesting piece last year called Six Native Leaders on What It Would Look Like If the U.S. Kept Its Promises. It says the U.S. has signed hundreds of treaties with indigenous peoples. Here's what would happen if the government actually honored them. And I just wonder how you both think about that. What does it mean for the U.S. government to honor treaties? I mean, that's a huge question, Emma, and we can spend the whole hour on it. But when it comes to basic necessities like water, how do you think about this issue?
It's exactly that. It's a basic necessity. We're not asking for anything that's crazy or new, except the ability to stay healthy by having water from safe sources. You know, one of the big problems on the Navajo Nation is that there are a lot of Superfund sites and a lot of uranium, and we are able to clean those up and we are able to make safe water sources. But again, we can't do that unless people, I mean, the federal government, are honoring treaties. And that's also something where, even on the most basic level of mental health, it doesn't feel good when the place that you're living doesn't really seem to care about you. And the most basic thing that they could do is honoring these very important documents that were signed after we were put into Wende, or, you know, basically a concentration camp after the Long Walk. And it's something that is really frustrating. And like you said, Native Nations know this. And I'm Googling the Vox piece right now because I haven't seen that, because I would be really interested in reading that. And again, it's not something that's only affecting water. It's affecting a lot of things.
What would you add, Jordan?
Mm-hmm. I think that I really want to read that Vox piece now. I think if the government did hold up their treaty obligations, it would be really, I feel like, a different world. You know, you would have, you know, healthcare would be, you know, tremendous. I think education too, because I think a lot of this time, I think of the teachers in all of our schools, and I used to be a high school teacher, they would have, you know, the resources at the tip of their fingers. You know, there would be, you know, probably less health disparities or health health issues that our people are dealing with at this point. Mental health services would be readily available for Native people. I think it would be an entirely different world.
Jordan Bennett Begay is Washington editor at Indian Country News. Jordan is a Diné citizen, and she's based in Washington, D.C. Emma Robbins is director of Dig Deep's Navajo Water Project, an indigenous-led, community-managed utility alternative that brings hot and cold running water to homes without access. And we should say that 1 in 3 Navajo do not have a sink or a toilet. Navajo are 67 times more likely than other Americans to live without running water or a toilet. And the Navajo Water Project is the first of its kind in the United States. And we really need to repeat that this is directly connected to broken treaties and U.S. obligations. If you have any questions for Emma or Jordan about how COVID is affecting Indian country and how it once again exposes these long-standing issues, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Emma, tell us a little bit about how you bring water to Navajo families. On your website, it says your work began with a single family in Thoreau, New Mexico, the Bensons, and has grown to serve more than 250 families across 9 towns in New Mexico alone. So tell us more about that work.
I'm so happy that we're talking about the work. I feel like whenever I talk about treaties, it sparks this thing where I'm like, this is so obvious. We need to take care of this now. So branching off of that into solutions, like we talked about, We are the Navajo Water Project. You can check out more of our work at NavajoWaterProject.org. And we are under the umbrella of Dig Deep Water, which is digdeepwater.org. I myself have been working for Dig Deep 4 years tomorrow, actually, and I have seen us spread from Peru, New Mexico, to Arizona and Utah. And what we're doing, as you explained a little bit earlier, we're installing off-grid cistern systems that rely on safe trucks water. And it's a pretty simple system. There is the cistern that goes underground. I think contrary to what a lot of people think, in these deserty areas, there can be freezing, plumbing, a pump, a water heater, a filter, and then we have a sink. Our next phase of our project after serving, which I'm proud to say is closer to 300 families at this point, we are now rolling out a septic pilot system, which will be great because it allows families to get indoor toilets, and that way people don't have to walk far distances to outhouses. We've also done a couple other projects where we have replaced plumbing, because one thing that people don't think about when it comes to running water is crumbling infrastructure, either on a larger scale or in individual schools and community centers. So we have helped a really great school called St. Michael's Association for Special Ed. They had some issues with lead and copper being leached into their systems, and we did that work. So it's been pretty interesting these past few weeks, shifting from doing long-term water access projects to doing relief and mutual aid work, but we're still getting people water, however that may look.
And how much does it cost, for example, to ensure that a family has access to clean water? And where do you get funding?
Yeah, so one thing that people forget as well is that you do need some sort of source of electricity to power a pump or a water heater, unless you have a gravity-fed system. But you do need that to get water into the house. So our systems that have solar power components, which is for most of the places that we install, is $4,500. So for $4,500 and with about 8 hours of work, you know, one day we're able to get families running water. We get our funding from a variety of sources. We don't currently have any federal or state funding, but we do work with really great foundations. We have a really wonderful woman who's our director of development, who's constantly working to get us money. One thing that's really important to us right now during COVID-19 is to continue to employ all of our staff and continue to have health insurance. So we're going after a lot of that, whatever it may look like. But yeah, it's been pretty great seeing, like I said, closer to 300 families get running water. And we're really excited for what's next, but also working hard during this pandemic.
You have a number of incredible videos on the website, and again, it's NavajoWaterProject.org. One of the videos says, water is medicine. Another, grateful for water, blessings for Baca. I'm sure that so many stories stand out for you. Do you want to share one or two?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of stories, but one group specifically that I want to touch on, which is about a year and a half ago, we started a project in a chapter called Nacitsan or Navajo Mountain, which is split between Arizona and Utah. And I mention that because they're in two different states and three different counties, and on the Navajo Nation, there are a lot of issues in terms of getting running water or even roads out there, for example. And so we are working in a community called Paiute Mesa, which is a part of that chapter, and they are considered to be one of the most rural areas in the entire Navajo Nation, but also the country. And so there's a group of families there. We have grandmas and grandpas and then young children there, and they've been told for decades that they're going to get running water. And I first heard about this from a colleague at Indian Health Service, actually, and we went out there, and, you know, I don't think that they thought we were going to follow through with our word. And working with their local government and our partner there, we were able to get about 17 families running water. And that was really great because in that area as well, we partnered with a great group of plumbers who actually installed bathrooms in three homes there. And it just is really important because in that area, people are still living traditional Navajo ways. They have their sheep. They're able to practice our culture and, I guess, religion. And getting running water to that area allows people to continue to stay there and continue to do that. And I think as a Diné woman, that's really important to me, to see that component of our work. It doesn't force people to move to larger cities. It allows them to have running water, but to continue the way that they've been living for decades.
Emma Robbins is director of Dig Deep's Navajo Water Project. And if you'd like to learn more about the important work that they do, you can find a link at yourcallradio.org. About one third of Navajo families haul water home every day, but thanks to the Navajo Water Project, that is changing. They have brought in water systems to 300 homes. We're also joined today by Jordan Bennett Begay, Washington editor at Indian Country Today. You know, Jordan, talking about the funding with Emma, when you think about, really, it's a small amount of money in the grand scheme of things to bring something like water. It's such a basic human right to Indian Country. Talking about COVID and funding, for example, and just what is needed in Indian Country, before we go to break, can you give us an update on the $8 billion that was supposed to go to tribal governments? It was $8 billion in direct emergency relief from the $2 trillion stimulus bill that became law last month. What is the status of that?
Yeah, sure. Our national correspondent, Jonathan Estes, reported on this Monday. And then the federal judge ordered the U.S. Treasury Secretary to halt the distribution of those relief funds to Alaska Native corporations because it was part of like a conflict in a lawsuit that's going on right now, where a lot of tribes from the lower 48 are saying that Alaska Native corporations shouldn't be receiving these funds because they're for for-profit corporations. So as of right now, you know, it opens the door for the Treasury Department to send checks to tribes. But, you know, there's like the question of if the Treasury Department is going to send money to Alaska Native corporations at this point. And as part of there's also like an additional, I think it was $2 billion. Some of it went to federal programs, federal Indian programs, and part of it was IHS, and so they are now allocating it across the Indian health system in various ways, like for telehealth activities, for medical equipment, for tribal epidemiology centers, sanitation, and testing kits and materials for IHS tribal and urban Indian health program.
Can you tell us more about Alaska Native corporations?
Yes, from what, so Alaska Native corporations, they're definitely different from the way that tribal governments are set up in the lower 48. And, Mark Trahant knows a lot more about this than I do, but from, Alaska Native corporations, you know, they're set up with the Alaska Native Settlement Act. And so instead of trying to set them up like traditional tribal governments in the lower 48, they set them up as corporations, so as businesses, in order, to streamline funding and, and they're a huge, part of the huge oil industry up in Alaska. So it's just the way their government systems are set up are definitely different from the lower 48 and like the traditional, Indian Reorganization Act, that happened in 1934. But up north, I think that's what, in the grand scheme of things, I think that's part of the lesson or understanding that is a disconnect in Indian Country, like knowing a lot of each other's histories when this is going on right now.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. That is Jordan Bennett Begay, Washington editor at Indian Country Today. Jordan is a Diné citizen. Emma Robbins is director of Dig Deep's Navajo Water Project, a community-managed utility alternative that brings hot and cold running water to Navajo homes without access to water or sewer lines. They've already brought water to 300 homes. It's the first system of its kind in the U.S. Emma is also a Diné citizen. Today we are talking about COVID-19 in Indian country and the lack of access to resources, which I'm sure you've probably heard about in the national media. It's really important to note that this is all directly connected to broken treaties and U.S. obligations. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. You can also post a comment or question on the website at yourcallradio.org. You may tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. On today's show, we are talking about COVID-19 in Indian country. There are nearly 1,600 confirmed cases of the virus on the Navajo Nation and 48 reported deaths. Today, we're joined by Jordan Bennett Begay, Washington editor at Indian Country Today. Jordan is a Diné citizen. Emma Robbins is director of Dig Deep's Navajo Water Project. They have brought water to 300 homes on the Navajo Nation. Emma is also a Diné citizen. And if you have any questions for Jordan or Emma, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's talk about what is happening on the Navajo Nation. Jordan, you did some data scraping in your recent piece behind these COVID-19 numbers. You used CDC data and discovered that the Navajo Nation has an infection rate 10 times that of the Indian health system. If the Navajo Nation was a state, it would rank third in terms of the highest reported cases behind New York and New Jersey. So what did you find when you actually looked at the data?
And everybody is wondering, you know, who ranks where. We really wanted the chance to tell readers, you know, this is the story behind the data and this is what it means. So when we look at, you know, infection rates and I guess case fatality rates, we had to think about what population data is being used in all of this. And when you think back, you know, to basic math and you do like a division, on top is the numerator and on bottom is the denominator. So when you divide that, you get, you know, whatever number comes out and you get the percentage of that when you multiply it by 100. But, I mean, to get out of the math, we had to really think about the population data that's being used because we were really curious about, you know, who's using what. And so when we looked at it, there are actually at least 5 different sources of denominators, at least population data, that could be used in Indian country. And even this gets very, very messy too. So people can use the 2010 census, the American Community Survey, the total tribal enrollment of all tribal nations, or the Indian Health Service user population or their service population number for this. But you know, in these 5 options, they're all flawed in many ways, right? The 2010 census, there's already, you know, a historic undercount of Native people in the census right now. And even, you know, with the pandemic going on, that's a question that many people are asking if there's going to be an accurate count. And that's done every 10 years. The American Community Survey is done, you know, every 5 to 2 years, depending which one you look at. And that just gets the population demographics. And they also get a small sample of the population, too. So it's much smaller than the census. The total tribal enrollment, there's really no one place where tribes can, you know, put this into the system, so we don't know. And the Indian Health Service user population and service population are, you know, very different. And, you know, when these numbers fluctuate, you know, we're saying, like, when these numbers fluctuate, that you're going to get different, I guess, infection rates or case fatality rates. So for the sake of numbers, we did just use the population data from the IHS. And we use their service population, which is, you know, a population of the people near their IHS facilities on a reservation or near their reservation. And so when we use IHS's service population, we did see that, to calculate the case fatality rate, I guess, which is when doctors can be sure people are killed by infection, we saw like there was a 3.72% case fatality rate in the Indian health system. So that's, you know, 3.7% of people who get COVID-19 are dying from this. I mean, I don't know. I can go on about the numbers, Rose. I just don't want to bore people with this. So I don't know what specifically you would want them to know at this point, because it is all about the numbers.
Right. Well, here's one thing you cite in your piece, that four Indigenous researchers from UCLA and the University of Arizona published a study in the Journal of Public Health Management and Practice. They found that the rate of COVID cases per 1,000 people on a reservation is more than four times higher than the United States as a whole.
Yes, they did. They did. And this is because, and so their study actually came from our data. So I think this talks about the beauty of data being public and being for people seeing this out there, because they came across it off of social media and were thinking of ways to, you know, show people and get analyze it. And it was just astounding to hear what they got. Like, they, you know, per 1,000 people on a reservation is more than four times higher than the United States as a whole. And they, part of their findings too that you just mentioned, you know, that their findings did conclude, or I guess confirm, that, you know, these COVID-19 cases do happen in tribal communities with a higher proportion of homes lacking indoor plumbing, you know, which is what we're talking about earlier with water, where there is prevalent household crowding and households where non-English languages are spoken. And, you know, these are things that, you know, have been talked about anecdotally, but now with data backs that up now. It's no longer, you know, an experience, and people can speak from their experiences, but until you have the data, it's, you know, it's like solid evidence that this is, you know, happening in tribal communities.
Right. And Emma, can you talk about what access to healthy food on the Navajo Nation?
Yeah, I just want to say I'm glad that Jordan's mentioning data. I was over here writing these things down, but I think that's also really important when we're talking about any of these things, whether it's healthy food, water, you know, missing and murdered Indigenous women, all of the different issues that we're facing. In terms of healthy foods on the Navajo Nation, I can speak specifically about beverages. A lot of times when people don't have clean drinking water, they'll turn to sugary beverages, right? Which obviously contributes to obesity, can contribute to diabetes, is just not healthy overall. In terms of being able to access healthy foods, there are 13 grocery stores total on the reservation. And considering we are a sovereign nation, that if we were a state, we'd be the 10th largest, that just isn't enough to serve everybody. So a lot of times the foods that people are getting are foods that will last a long time. And so it's not always fresh, healthy fruits and vegetables, or, you know, the fruits and vegetables that do arrive to the reservation have to travel a pretty long way, and it might not always be the top quality.
There have been many stories about just various programs and community organizations getting together to bring in fresh vegetables, to bring in just basic resources that are needed. Can you talk about some of those efforts, Emma?
Yeah, in terms of COVID right now, there have been a lot of really great, I want to give a shout out to Indigenous women specifically who are working on this. Last week, I spoke with someone who was talking about, and her reservation bringing fish to elders during this time, which was very important because it was a food that they were very used to eating and they wanted to continue to make that happen. In terms on the Navajo Nation, there have been two women who have organized a really great effort. Their names are Ethel Branch and Jessica Sago, and they started with a GoFundMe to get food and water out to families who wouldn't be able to access that during quarantine or the 57-hour curfews on the weekend. And they're out there delivering food in terms of, you know, during COVID and non-pandemic times. There is the Utah Dine Sakea group, and they're doing a lot of stuff with seeds, which is important as well because I know it's not like full-on grown fruits and vegetables being delivered. It's still really important because it's encouraging people to be able to have that food, and especially food that's traditional to us, in abundance and during the summer. And it's something that's really important to maintain.
We talked a little bit about the healthcare system. What are you hearing, Emma, in terms of what is needed right now and what healthcare, you know, frontline workers are facing? I mentioned Dr. Michelle Tom in the intro. She's been quoted quite a bit in the media. She works for the Little Colorado Medical Center in Winslow, Arizona. And she told NBC she only has access to two ventilators. As she says, the virus is draining the resources and she's concerned that her facility will go under once the pandemic is managed.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, I know these are a lot of numbers, but they're important numbers to know. On the Navajo Nation, again, if we were a state, we'd be the 10th largest. There are physically 16 hospitals on the nation. They've set up two temporary field hospitals. There are 19 total serving the reservation. Some are off the res in border towns. The number of hospital beds on the reservation is 400. And that is obviously a very small amount considering at this time we have almost 2,000 COVID patients on the Navajo Nation. The total number of beds that we have in the ICU is only 46. And in terms of what is needed on the reservation is PPE, you know, personal protective equipment, whether those are face shields, masks. I know that the ventilators are a big issue as well. And I just feel like it's really scary when a lot of these places are serving people who, again, aren't able to wash their hands when they do come to clinics. I know we're in desperate need, dig deep personally, and the people that we're working are really great on the ground partners. We need things to not only be able to protect them and our team, but also sanitation supplies, because what we're doing right now is we're delivering almost 248,000 gallons of bottled water. And once that shipment arrives, we need to be able to clean that properly. So I know here in LA, it's really hard to find bleach wipes and bleach to make bleach solution. We need that on the Navajo Nation as well.
And I should mention that Civil Eats spoke with Ade Romero Briones, director of the Native Agricultural and Food Program. And she said, "We just did a large water purchase. That makes me so upset. Water is a basic human right, and we're having to purchase water from a corporation that doesn't serve our communities in the first place." She says, "There are so many things about this situation that makes me upset."
Yeah, I mean, that makes total sense. It is very silly to think of the idea of purchasing water, and especially an individual bottle. But, you know, right now, unfortunately, that's something that we need, right? Again, like I said, we're having to shift from being a long-term water access project to just getting immediate aid out there. I know that it's a very big issue, but I do want to say that we have been working with Nestle, who actually donated this water, delivery included. And again, I know that it can be a complicated situation, but it's amazing what this company is doing, you know, and working with the Navajo Water Project just to make sure that we're getting what we need out there immediately.
Do you know, Jordan, will any of the CARES money go to clean water in Indian Country?
That is a really good question. And honestly, I really don't know the question to that. And that's probably something we can definitely look into.
Do you know, Emma? It seems like that's a no-brainer. That should be near the top of the list.
I'm so sorry. Can you repeat that again?
No, that's okay.
Just for a second. Yeah.
That's okay. In the CARES Act, I'm wondering if we're talking about $8 billion for Native tribes, do we know how much of that money will go to water access?
You know, that's also something that I can't answer, and something that I definitely, along with the Vox article, am Googling right now to research afterwards.
All right. Well, yeah, we'll definitely. Yeah, Jordan, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, Rose, and I think that a lot of that, the $8 billion does go to tribes, but it would be up to each of the tribes to get part of that money on what they do with it. So, and it all has to be COVID-19 related.
Mm-hmm. And once the tribes get that money, how are the people involved in deciding how the money is dispersed? I'm sure it varies from tribe to tribe, right?
Oh, yes. Definitely. I mean, still the question is what formula are they using to disperse this to tribes? Like, are they going by enrollment or population, like in their area? Are they going by land base? Or because a lot of tribes don't have, you know, a land base, too. So even that is unknown. It's something I know we've been trying to figure out the past few weeks.
That is Jordan Bennett-Begay, Washington editor at Indian Country Today. Jordan is a Diné citizen. Emma Robbins is director of Dig Deep's Navajo Water Project, an indigenous-led community-managed utility alternative that brings hot and cold running water to Navajo homes. So far, they have served 300 homes without access to water or sewer lines. Emma is also a Diné citizen, and you can find more information about the Water Project and read Jordan's pieces at yourcallradio.org. Today we're talking about COVID-19 in Indian country and broken treaties and U.S. obligations and what really needs to happen to ensure that all families have access to clean running water and then just basic infrastructure. Healthy food. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org, or if you have a short story to share, you can tweet us at yourcallradio. We have an email from Ruby, and she writes, "I think many of us, not Native peoples, believe casinos have made Indians rich. At least that's what I get in response whenever I bring up the subject to the not knowing what they're talking about people. Can your guests give us any ammunition to those of us who want to speak intelligently about the problems in Native nations? For example, treaties not honored, etc." Jordan, how would you answer that question?
Yeah, so actually Harvard just came out with some findings showing that tribal casinos, you know, will be losing approximately $1.1 million because of, you know, the pandemic, and those are all related to jobs. I mean, those are related to jobs, and a lot, or 1.1 million jobs, sorry, and about 900,000 of those jobs are held by non-Native people, and around 200,000 of those jobs are held by Native people. Which is really, I mean, interesting to me because, you know, I grew up on Navajo and I know, you know, there are many, you know, tribes who own casinos, but the fact that a lot of non-Native people have jobs in tribal casinos is pretty astounding to me. Hmm. And it just shows, you know, how connected and how these tribal casinos do, you know, are, you know, a part of the huge economy in their area. And when I talked to one of the researchers, he was saying that sometimes, and often, you know, sometimes, like, these casinos are the driving, they drive the economy in the region. One casino was pointed out was in Arizona, in one of the counties. And I can't remember what casino it was. And, you know, if that's the economy driver for them, then, you know, what are they doing now that the casino is closed?
And what would you add, Emma?
You know, I think it's important to know that not every tribe has super prospering casinos. I know that, you know, the Navajo Nation, I think we have about 4 or 5 total. And for the longest time, we voted against having them. I think, Jordan, I'm sure I'm a little bit older than you. I'm not sure. But I personally didn't grow up with the concept of casinos. It was something that was super foreign. And so I'm still personally learning a lot about the way that they work logistically in terms of finances and whatnot. But, you know, the money that casinos make, those don't necessarily go back to Navajos. Like, I know that we don't, there are tribes that do get per cap, you know, they are getting paid out by their tribes every month or every year, whatever it is. But a very small percentage of casino money goes to individual chapters, which are local governments on the Navajo Nation. And that's to cover things like their utilities, right? We're not, this is like my way of saying it, we're not bawling out of control and we're like dripping in money. It's just, you know, I think the thing that's important to know too, that on the Navajo Nation, it's not like in central locations right outside of cities. They're off of I-40 generally, and it's not like a ton of people are traveling to those places. So, you know, on one hand, we're still paying back what it is to construct these casinos and maintain them. And then two, we're not having super high revenue, and the revenue that we are getting is going to important local government infrastructure. And a lot of times, you know, we do have funding for water programs and whatnot, but that doesn't always come from casinos. I also want to say that's a question that I get a lot, along with, oh, you're Native, so you must go to school for free. I have about $60,000 of student debt, so those are always two myths that I try and debunk, because not everybody is a rich casino person and not everybody is going to college for free.
Yeah, exactly. And not every tribe mm-hmm. is connected to a casino. And even if they are, not every tribal member benefits from that. One other thing, mm-hmm. Ruby, there's actually an exhibit at the Native American Museum in D.C. about broken treaties. And so this might be one way for you to maybe educate people, just, you know, to ask them to read about treaties. It doesn't have to be a huge book if they don't want to dive deep, if they just want an article. There are so many out there. And that kind of brings us back full circle. I just want to ask both of you, you know, it's disconcerting sometimes when the media, you know, the only thing they focus on when it comes to Indian country is poverty and suicide. And yes, these issues are so incredibly important. But there's so many other things happening in Indian country. And when you do look at these many, many problems, we really have to talk about U.S. obligations and broken treaties. It has to be part of the conversation. So going back full circle, what are some other solutions at this time you would like to see, Emma, now that these issues are getting attention in the national news?
We need to continue it. You know, we need to take this momentum and continue to educate people and put our voices out there. I think it's similar to things like Standing Rock, for example. A lot of people said things afterwards like, oh, the Native, you know, quote unquote, lost. That was a battle that was, you know, horrible. Nothing played out how we wanted to. That's not true. You know, things like Standing Rock sparked a huge indigenous-led movement. It brought a lot of people to start paying attention to Native American issues, especially those that are related to the environment and, again, treaties, like you mentioned. But it's the same thing here. Now that the American public and the world is starting to see that Native nations are struggling so much on whatever level from the pandemic, it's important that we keep those voices and those stories on the forefront and not let anybody else forget about it. I am a very big advocate of educating people, and rather than shutting down conversations that we often have with you're prejudiced, you're racist, you're dumb, you don't know anything, it's really important to now be able to reference these things. You know, Jordan said she referenced a couple of articles, which again, over here Googling, but that's great because we are able to point someone in the right direction. And, you know, as she said, hey, Harvard did this research, take a look at this article. It's something where we are starting to be mentioned a lot more. I think oftentimes people just think we don't exist anymore or it's out of sight, out of mind. And we just have to make sure to hold people accountable to that, whether that means calling their elected officials and saying, hey, like, let's talk about where this funding is going, or also just making sure that we're looking out for our sisters and brothers on the reservation. And a lot of that, again, is just happening because people are starting to open their eyes. I'm not saying that it's a Band-Aid that's going to fix everything, but it is a good start to, again, be able to say, hey, remember, you did care about this. Continue to care about it 365.
Exactly, and continue to care about it post-COVID. Continue to focus on these things, because on CNN the other night, Chris Cuomo had on the president of the Navajo Nation, and it sounded like it was the first time Chris Cuomo had ever talked about Native issues on his show, and I'm really glad he did, because he has such a massive platform. But I hope that, you know, he and others continue after COVID. What would you add, Jordan?
I agree. I get really frustrated by the focus of poverty by mainstream media. And oftentimes they tell the same story over and over again. And I think I've come to the point where I kind of just ignore it, because they are things that we've already been reporting on. Like, how else can they push the story forward? And that's what we're rethinking at Indian Country today, is how, you know, it's definitely, Indian Country is much more complex than a lot of mainstream media think that they have it. There's a lot of context behind it. And oftentimes they, you know, cover the Lower 48, or they cover reservations. They don't think about urban Indians. They don't think about Alaska. You know, they're very much a part of Indian Country as well. They don't think about, like, a lot of, you know, Native people who have land straddling the border in, you know, the U.S. and Mexico, and of Canada and the U.S. too, because they are also going, you know, experiencing, you know, difficulties at this time with the pandemic. You know, and a lot of times, you know, these mainstream journalists, like, you know, if they're going to cover these areas, if they can cover Indian Country or Native affairs or Indigenous affairs, they need to also not parachute in and then, like, and, you know, just leave and continue doing everything else. Like, they need to stay and talk to, you know, talk to community members. And if anything, I think that's what Native journalists are really good at, is, you know, we know our communities, we know our issues, and we have, you know, we know the complexities of it all, and have these relationships that we've built over the years. And part of those relationships right now, and even just in this data collection that we've been doing, is trust. And that's a huge factor in all of this. You know, Native people have to be able to trust one another, there's issues with trust with the government and with the health system. And this is revealing a lot of that right now. And, you know, non-Native media can also go to NAJA, the Native American Journalists Association, for resources and their style guide. You know, they have the bingo card to avoid, you know, romanticizing all these stories that are surrounding the coronavirus.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we will continue following this issue. We'd love to have you both back. Jordan Bennett Begay is Washington editor at Indian Country Today. Emma Robbins is director of Dig Deep's Navajo Water Project. They have brought water to 300 families on the Navajo Nation. Jordan and Emma are both Diné citizens. Thank you both so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and David Latulipe for keeping the studio running. Find more information about today's show at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.